evening, ladies and gentlemen, and as we say back home, in different languages, Molweni, Dumalang, Sanibonani. 3 days into a three-month sabbatical at Berkeley, as the Vice Chancellor, or as you call it, the President of Rhodes University, South Africa, it's my great pleasure to introduce to you one of South Africa's most respected foreign relations experts. Honorable Ibrahim Ismail Ibrahim, South Africa's Deputy Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, is not only a hero in the long and arduous struggle against apartheid, he is also a veteran of many conflict resolution initiatives and has been actively involved in efforts to resolve conflict in Israel/Palestine, in Burundi, Kosovo, Bolivia, and Nepal, and between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Minister Ibrahim joined the anti-apartheid liberation movement as a youth activist in 1952 and participated in the famous Congress of the People campaign, which formulated and adopted South Africa's Freedom Charter in 1955. After the banning of the African National Congress in 1960, he joined the armed wing of the ANC. He was arrested in 1963 and charged under the Sabotage Act with 18 other accused. After serving a 15-year prison sentence on Robben Island in the company of Nelson Mandela and other ANC leaders, he was released in 1979, only to be banned and restricted to his home in Durban. In 1980, he went into exile and was charged with the liberation movement of spearheading the ANC's underground activities from the frontline states bordering South Africa. In December 1986, he was kidnapped from Swaziland by South African security forces, detained in South Africa, and as is well known, was savagely tortured. He was charged for high treason and again sentenced to prison on Robben Island, this time for 20 years. In 1991, following a period of liberalization, remember the famous 2nd February 1990 speech of the then President de Klerk, which released Nelson Mandela and unbanned the ANC. In this context, the appeal court ruled that the kidnapping from a foreign country was illegal and the South African court had no jurisdiction to try him. He was then released from prison. In July 1991, he was elected to the very powerful National Executive Committee of the ANC and also became a member of its National Working Committee. During the Convention for a Democratic South Africa and negotiations in the early 1990s, Minister Ibrahim was tasked by the ANC to establish the Patriotic Front. The Patriotic Front brought together some 90 political, community, civic, and religious organizations, with its aim being to achieve consensus on both the process as well as the final outcome of the negotiations that led to the establishment of a democratic South Africa. And then following the first democratic elections of 1994, Minister Ibrahim was elected a member of the National Assembly of the South African Parliament. In August 1997, he was elected chairperson of the Foreign Affairs Committee and also became a member of the Joint Select Committee on Intelligence. He resigned from Parliament in July 2002 to take up the position of Senior Political and Economic Advisor to the Deputy President of South Africa. And it was on his behalf that he became actively involved in conflict resolution efforts around the globe. In 2006, Minister Ibrahim was appointed as Head of International Affairs at the ANC head office in Johannesburg. In 2009, he was appointed Deputy Minister of International Relations and Cooperation and continues to serve on the ANC's National Executive Committee. This evening, Minister Ibrahim has kindly agreed to address us on South Africa's conflict resolution role in Africa and to provide some insights and perspectives on the current state of Africa's conflict zones, the outlook for peace and reconciliation, and South Africa's role as mediator in the rest of Africa. And with South Africa well into its second year as a non-permanent member of the UN Security Council, you will also touch, hopefully, on South Africa's role in this body, the relationship between the African Union and the UN Security Council, and the extent of the global community's efforts to either end conflicts in Africa or perhaps sometimes not to help end conflicts in Africa. With those words, I welcome and hand you over to Deputy Minister Ibrahim.
Thank you, Salim Badat. Despite all what he said, you mustn't think I'm as old as what he made me out to be. Well, ladies and gentlemen, and program director, in a year marking the centenary of the African National Congress, the African National Congress was formed in 1912. And this year we marked our centenary celebrations. It gives me great pleasure to address the Commonwealth Club of California on the role our nation has played in conflict resolution on the African continent. In the short time in which our young democracy has re-entered the international community, we have worked extremely hard to achieve a more peaceful and a very stable continent. This is because we recognize that no factor has hindered the realization of the continent's vast potential more than the chronic outbreak of crisis and conflict on our continent. South Africa's transition from apartheid to democracy is looked to by many as a model for resolution of conflict throughout the world, and not least in Africa, while continuing to serve as inspiration to other nations attempting to free themselves from the vices of war. I must say that recently we have been sharing our experience on transition and transformation in many countries, particularly those that have been involved in the Arab uprising. Commenting on the hopes that South Africa symbolizes in 1996, former U.S. Secretary of State Warren Christopher eloquently said, and I quote, If this diverse, once divided nation can be united by common values and aims, then too can any multi-ethnic nation in Africa and the world. If South Africa can forge a community of interest with its neighbors it once fought, then any region can come together, end quote. Our first democratically elected leader, former President Mandela, noted that while South Africa would intervene to resolve the continent's festering disputes on moral grounds, such intervention was by all means a strategic consideration as well. By noting the great degree of interconnectedness between South Africa and the continent, it was in our nation's best interest to play an active role in conflict resolution in order not fall victim to the many forces which had brought ruins to its various parts. South Africa's foreign policy responses to crisis and conflict across the continent can subsequently be understood through the confluence of moral and practical reasoning and justification. Encapsulating the spirit of these principles, South Africa's policies are guided by the philosophy of Ubuntu, meaning humanity. This overarching philosophy reflects our nation's belief that we affirm our humanity when we affirm the humanity of others. This philosophy has further informed our unique approaches to global issues. It has provided the basis for our recognition that it is in our national interest to promote and support the positive development in Africa and within the greater international community. Distinguished guests, given these efforts and initiatives, South Africa has wholly embraced multilateralism as an approach to confront the many challenges facing the continent as well as the international community. As a non-permanent member of the United Nations Security Council from 2007 to 2008, as well as for the period 2011 and 2012, we have promoted peace and security with an emphasis on Africa, while we have duly worked to strengthen cooperation between the United Nations Security Council and regional organizations such as the AU Peace and Security Council. Ladies and gentlemen, key to many of our efforts was South Africa's hosting on 2 July 2002, Durban Summit, which inaugurated the African Union as a new Pan-African institution, replacing the old African OAU, the Organization of African Unity. As the Union's first chair for the period 2002 and 2003, former President Thabo Mbeki helped lay the foundation of a robust continental peace and security architecture anchored on regional mechanism and effectively linked to the Organization of the United Nations Infrastructure on Global Peace. The protocol which endorsed the Peace and Security Council at the Durban 2002 summit provided for, inter alia, a continental early warning system, an African standby force, an eminent panel of the wise, and a special peace fund as the primary pillars of the African Union peace and security architecture. While significant in itself, South Africa played a leading role in shaping the formative years of the African Union peace and security architecture by, among other things, advocating an early and rapid response to continental challenges. Furthermore, the Constitutive Act of the African Union and the African Union Peace and Security Council provide the legal foundation of Africa's new security framework. In a break with the past, its most innovative provision is that even though the Act confirms adherence to the principle of non-interference in the internal affairs of its member states, it concedes the right of the Union to intervene in a member state pursuant to the decision of the Assembly in respect of grave circumstances, namely war crime, genocide, and crime against humanity. We had the example of Darfur, Somalia, and Burundi. Even when the United Nations was not prepared to intervene, it was left to the African Union to intervene in these areas. In the past decade, the African Union's new architecture has been extremely effective in dealing with scores of conflict, from a peak of 16 conflicts in 2002, Africa is fast achieving peace and stability with only a handful of conflict remaining, like Somalia and Mali. in addition to contributing to the building of a continental architecture to entrench peace, South Africa has also played a direct role in conflict prevention, conflict resolution, management, and post-conflict stabilization in the African countries such as Sudan, Comoros, Burundi, DRC, Lesotho, the Central African Republic, and elsewhere. As part of this contribution, we have encouraged the substantial deployment of South African National Defense Force as well as the South African Police Service, men and women to numerous countries across the continent, as well as playing leading roles in conflict and post-conflict societies in Africa through mediation and preventive diplomacy. Following a 1996 peace process launched by the OAU in Burundi, former President Nelson Mandela, aided by the prior efforts of former President of Tanzania, Julius Nyerere, engaged in vigorous diplomacy as the process key mediator, culminating in the significant Arusha Accord in August of 2000. The accord provided a durable framework for peace and, most importantly, laid the foundation for a three-year transitional government. Continuous round of negotiations, skillfully headed by our then Deputy President Jacob Zuma, drummed up support from significant regional and international actors and cudgeled the fractious Burundi's political parties and armed group into adhering to the accord. What followed was a clear break from Burundi's experience in the 1990s, characterized by armed ethnic violence and a fragmented population besieged by the violence of numerous rebel groups. Moreover, the accord called for the establishment of an international peacekeeping force, of which South Africa provided a substantial troop presence up until the African National Congress, until the African Union assumed control in April 2003 as part of the African Mission in Burundi, AMIB. The application of this growing South African experience and capacity can be evidenced in such cases as the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, in which we emerge as a principal broker between the many conflicting interests and parties to what became known as the Inter-Congolese Dialogue. These efforts were aimed squarely at addressing the escalating crisis associated with the Second Congo War, in which numerous states from Southern and Central Africa were drawn into the maelstrom of this internationalized civil war. Throughout the dialogue process, South Africa maintained a constant diplomatic presence and further supported the efforts of the United Nations Mission on the DRC through its provision of peacekeepers. Our efforts at conflict resolution with respect to the inter-Congolese dialogue culminated in the global and all-inclusive peace accord, which was signed in Pretoria on 17 December 2002 and endorsed at the Sun City on 2 April 2003. This accord provided for a transitional constitution and a power-sharing government incorporating all of the working factions. South Africa has never ceased to support efforts aimed at keeping the agreement and the total stability of the DRC. Similar cases of South Africa's intervention towards conflict resolution can further be seen in the cases of Cote d'Ivoire, Madagascar, Zimbabwe, and Lesotho. We have steadily worked through SADC since 2009 in Madagascar in order to mediate and seek a peaceful solution to to the country's political stalemate following the unconstitutional seizure of power by Andre Rajoelina from the incumbent Marc Ravalomanana. We have also been actively engaged in the many challenges arising from the political contestation in Zimbabwe throughout the past decade. President Zuma and former President Mbeki played a leading role in this regard as SADC-appointed mediators, working around a very complex political situation which had the potential of leading Zimbabwe into a complete state of collapse, a situation of dire consequence for the Southern African region. South Africa has also played an active role in North and South Sudan, with particular emphasis in the conflict-ridden Darfur region. We have supported the implementation of the comprehensive agreement between the Khartoum government and the Southern People's Liberation Army or Movement, SPLA or SPLM, which was brokered by the Intergovernmental Authority on Development and signed in Nairobi in January 2005. We have also chaired the committee for the post-conflict reconstruction of Sudan, created by a decision of the AU Executive Council in Maputo in July 2003. Since the humanitarian crisis in Darfur erupted in 2003, we have supported the African Union's efforts and capacity building of its mission in Sudan. Moreover, South Africa joined a core of 15 countries which ensured troop, civilian, and police deployment to the African mission in Sudan. Moreover, we have also spearheaded the African Union post-conflict reconstruction efforts in South Sudan. Whilst we duly chaired the 20 October 2004 meeting of the African Union Peace and Security Council, which resolved to significantly expand the African mission in Sudan from under 500 troops and civilian police to more than 3,000. Of course, our former President Mbeki, you know, is heading the high-level panel of Southern Sudan, where he is dealing with the post-succession issue between South Sudan and the North. While this effort underscores the steps our nation has taken in implementing the ideals and principles which inform our foreign policy responses to conflict throughout Africa, such endeavors must be tempered by a holistic understanding of the many challenges facing our country, as well as the continent, with regards to institutional, political, and financial constraints. Nonetheless, remaining cognizant of our influence as a middle power, South Africa has played to its strength within the international system in order to promote the African agenda and seek a dignified and equitable place for the continent's people within this system. I cannot think of a better expression to capture what has been our approach to international relations in general and the African challenges in particular. Then what was said in 1978 by the late president of the African National Congress, Oliver Tambo, and I quote, "However forbidden the sacrifice we in South Africa have to make as a price of victory, it is drafted by the greatness, the supreme nobility, and above all the absolute justice of the cause for which we fight. inevitably we shall win. Africa will be totally liberated. A new and fully democratic world order will be born. And as the African National Congress declared in its Freedom Charter, there shall be peace and friendship. I thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. I'd like to remind our audience listening at home that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is South Africa's Role in Conflict Resolution with Mr. Ibrahim Ishmael Ibrahim, Deputy Minister of International Relations and Cooperation of the Republic of South Africa. Now I'm going to turn it back to Mr. Ibrahim, who is going to chat with Dr. Salim Badat, and then we're going to open it up for a conversation with the audience. But Dr. Badat, would you like to lead off with a few remarks and response?
Thank you. I'm going to conduct this dialogue in the spirit that universities play a particular role, and I embody the university, if you like, as its president or its vice chancellor. We are always empathetic to the challenges that a state faces, especially in a very difficult and complex world, but we, as universities, we are also required to be critical and to speak truth to power if necessary. And so I would like us to engage in this dialogue in that kind of culture, if you like. And let me kick off by asking the Deputy Minister, in general, would you say that is Africa a better place, a better space in 2012 than, say, a decade ago?
Yes, Africa is a better place today than it was a decade ago. Economically, of course, it's making tremendous progress. It has been identified as the fastest growing region of the world. And economists are convinced that the next growth point is going to grow faster than countries in East Asia. Politically, I think that the AU's decision that they were not going to recognize any country or any government power that came in, that took power unconstitutionally, is an important step forward, because many countries on the continent have had democratic elections, and there has been a change in government peacefully. Although there have been problems in some of the countries, of course, you would quote Cote d'Ivoire. And then we have what is called a peer review mechanism. About 30 countries have signed up on this peer review mechanism. Outsiders always review us and comment on our status and our activities, and we felt we should do that ourselves. And I think that there has been, of course, challenges. We think the African Union needs to be strengthened. That is why we have SADC has put forward a candidature for the African Union to strengthen this organ. But looking at Africa as a whole, I think it's making forward progress all the time. Democratic institutions have been set, democratic elections are taking place, and institution building is an important aspect I think Africa is engaged in. And South Africa, of course, will contribute and has contributed in whichever way we could in trying to foster good governance, accountability, and democracy. But not to say that there are no conflicts on the continent. The conflicts have lessened now than they were, say, a decade ago.
Thank you. Others? Donovan?
My question is regarding picking up on what Rhodes has done, has set up a Center for Ethical Leadership. My view is that ethical leadership is in short supply across Africa. How do you respond to that?
Well, Well, yes, of course, ethical leadership in the past, of course, has been a serious problem. It is still a problem. But I think that we in South Africa have set up some institutions. The former president, Thabo Mbeki, has also set up an institution training African leaders. Part of it is ethical leadership. So. And there are problems, of course, of mismanagement, corruption. It's a problem that we also have in our own country, but we are managing it. We're trying to address those issues. And coming from the colonial past, Africa has been not only victim of colonialism, but somehow victim of the Cold War as well. And big power politics played some role, if not in a crucial role, in determining or overlooking some of the mismanagement and probably encouraging it as well. That is why we are very much, our former President Mbeki spoke of the African Renaissance, the renewal of Africa. And also the fact that we are saying there should be African solution to African problems is part of keeping out, not to say that we don't want to cooperate with the international community and don't need the aid of the international community, but to try to say that Africans must take a lead in solving their own problems. And that can only be done if there is proper leadership, if there's ethical leadership, and there's a fight against poverty and corruption and things related to poverty and corruption. Yeah. With the economic growth of the continent, I think that it also begins to address some of the question of ethical leadership.
So I want to commend you on what South Africa is doing in terms of international relationships and African relationships within Africa, in the Sudan example, etc. However, we've got our own problems in South Africa. The largest problem, and I call it also conflict resolution, is the lack of education. And whilst I appreciate you say that Africans should solve their own problems, that is not necessarily the best remedy. Because if you don't tap into the intellectual capacity of the world and some of the world leaders, we have South Africans in this country. Elon Musk is a typical example. He left South Africa because the opportunities were not there. There are many other South Africans, the diaspora, that have achieved higher success. So the question of Africans should resolve their own problems is going back to a situation where you're not tapping into the best talent of the world. And while South Africa spends the largest amount on education, the system of education is one of the poorest in the world. Can you comment on that, please?
Yeah, there are two issues here, I suppose. Education is one issue, and I'm sure the Rhodes University has recognized the problems that we have with education, which then goes into the question of skill and capacity, etc. And I think that it is a serious problem, you would say, education. And I think that our education department are hands-on, they're very seriously tackling this issue, is part of a larger debate in South Africa. And the government, of course, is very committed to addressing the education issues. I learned in the United States, I was reading the other day, also education is becoming a problem here. So it's probably a universal thing. You see, when we say, and of course we need to tap in with the diaspora. We had a very successful conference in South Africa a month ago on the African diaspora, which was very successful. Many people from the United States attended. We're thinking that should be one of the six regions of Africa. And when we say, you see, Africa should resolve their own problem, that there should be African solution to African problem. It does not mean that, you know, we cut off the outside world. We cannot live in a vacuum. I mean, the world is interconnected. We're living in a global world. We are saying so because we need the assistance of the outside community, the international organizations, and some of the big powers to assist in solving African problem. But the leadership must come, the initiative must come from Africa. We don't want France to say because they have influence on Francophone Africa, and they must decide, because many of the African Francophone countries, the foreign reserves are held in Paris. What influence, you know, we don't want negative influence coming through. I think the international community could play a very constructive role to assist Africa if they allow Africa space to begin to resolve the problem and assist in that direction. We're living in a complex world, geopolitics coming to, you know, when I came in, became a minister, I was surprised to see what a lot of interest there is in Africa. You have the Chinese Africa Forum, you have the India Africa Forum, you have the Japanese Africa TICA, then you have the South Koreans, the Vietnamese Africa Forum, you got the Turkish Africa Forum. Everybody is concentrating on Africa. There may be a reason for that, because we have got, we are sitting with tons of mineral wealth. We have 60% of land that is not cultivated. People speaking of food security. Many of the Arab states are probably buying land and talking of, whenever you go to the Middle East, the first thing they talk of food security. So we have an important role to play internationally. We welcome the interest that these countries are showing on our continent. But we want to partner. We don't want the same colonial relationship where they come and take away our raw material. And somebody was saying to me the other day, you know, the best chocolate is Swiss, isn't it? The Switzerland. I don't eat chocolate, I'm sure. But where does the cocoa come from? They come from Africa, you see. I mean, why don't we, Africa make the best chocolate? But you see, the we need to have a relationship which would benefit. Of course, it must benefit both sides. But we think that that the international community must not begin to interfere in the politics of Africa in a negative way, but they should assist. Our president, Jacob Zuma, addressed the UN Security Council in December. It was a month where we were chairing the Security Council. And he spoke of cooperation between the UN Security Council and the AU Peace and Security Council. How they could meet, they should meet once a year or twice a year, I think, and there should be cooperation between these two bodies so they do not act in a manner that that undermine the security of the continent. I don't know whether I've answered that.
Dr. Badar, would you like to address that as well, please?
Well, I was going to, indeed, why doesn't Africa make its own chocolate? But you could ask that about many other things also. But here's the challenge. We had the Chinese ambassador at Rhodes about a year ago. And before I could raise the issue with him, he took me aside and said, you know, lots of people ask us, what's the agenda of China in Africa? And unashamedly, he said, of course we have an agenda. Do you have an agenda? And I think he's absolutely right. And let me ask that. Does Africa have an agenda?
Yes, the Chinese do have an agenda, I would say.
The Americans have an agenda.
I say to when people complain about China, I say, look, Africa has got a lot of wealth. It's got mineral wealth. It brings it out in the surface. It has to sell it. Whether you sell it to the Americans, to the British, or the French, or the Belgium, or the Chinese, you'll sell it to the country that gives you the best deal. The Chinese are giving you the better deal because they're building roads, they're building railways. In the end of the day, they're doing it for their own purpose because they can transport the goods. And our agenda should be that we should have a strategic relationship where we should partner, where whoever comes, whether it's Chinese are coming to Africa, okay, they want to invest, they want to build roads and railways and build a big headquarters at the AU. And I think they're doing that in Algeria too the other day. But they must not just come and take our raw materials and dump cheap Chinese goods and destroy our manufacturing, like our textile and clothing industry. But our agenda should be, because when we went to China and they said, all right, they tell us, look, we want to buy from you. Tell us what you have got. What can we buy from you? They got, and of course, they'll buy raw material from us, but we need to beneficiate our material and say to the Chinese, or anybody else for that matter, you don't just take gold. We export gold in bars. And then we buy the jewelries that are produced God knows where. And so there has to be a beneficiation. There has to partner with local communities, local businesses. So our agenda should be that what can we get out of whether the Chinese, the Indians, or the Americans or the French? What can South Africa benefit as a continent? And we must get the best out of whatever deal we have. I don't know whether that answers the question.
Others?
I live in the United States of America, so to ask if the continent of Africa has an agenda, to me, is somewhat naive. I don't think that the continent of North America has an agenda. So I was curious when you spoke about the role of the Constitution and the concept of Ubuntu and the role that South Africa might play in developing a continental agenda for Africa. I was interested in hearing about that because I'm just wondering about the role of South Africa in actually forwarding an agenda for the continent of Africa.
Whether South Africa has an agenda... Yes and no. We have an agenda because we want a peaceful continent. We don't want to be an island of prosperity surrounded by countries that are living in poverty. We have an agenda because we want peace on the continent. We know that you cannot develop economically if there's war. I mean, there's wastage that is going on. People have been killed. We have a neighbor like Zimbabwe. If there's a problem in Zimbabwe, we have about over 3 million illegals in our country. And people are coming, when there is conflict, people flock into South Africa because South Africa is the most developed economy. And our agenda, we say we want to create a better Africa and a better world. And our agenda is, you see, many African leaders, they come to us scolding us, like I know the president of Tanzania was in South Africa and he addressed us to say, you know, he can't understand why South Africa is reluctant to take up leadership. Many African leaders are saying to us that we want your leadership. Okay, you want our leadership, but even... From the time of Mandela, we have been a bit cautious, don't want to appear as big brother, you know, dominant figure in Africa. You've got to treat us as equal partners, no matter how strong you are, how weak you are. And we play our role within the regional or the continental organizations. We have an agenda. We want to put our candidate of Southern Africa into the AU, because we want to strengthen the AU. We want to strengthen the AU because we know that the strong AU will be able to tackle some of the pressing issues of conflict, its relationship with the United Nations and other international fora. We have an agenda. You see, South Africa is a small country with a small population, small GDP. For want of a better word, I would say we are in the big league. We are part of IPSA, that is Brazil, India, South Africa. We are not part of BRICS. I mean, compared to BRICS, to South Africa, but why would BRICS want us to be part of that? Many countries are strong because of military power. The more you have military power, the more stronger you are. You know, the United States and China, for this, Russia. But we are not a military power. But I think we have a moral power there. I always say to our leadership, you know, when it got its independence, it's a very poor country during the time of Nehru and Gandhi. But it gave moral leadership to the world. People looked to India because it gave a moral leadership. It's not a military power. So our strength doesn't come from our military strength. I think our strength comes from the moral leadership that we could give to the international community, to the world. And as I said, you know, many people are coming to us now. The Egyptians, the Tunisians, the Libyans, the Iraqis, there was a big Iraqi delegation of 15 people, want to know our Truth and Reconciliation Commission, how we were able to manage transition and so forth. So that's where probably our strength comes from, and our agenda is not. Many people accept us because we have no material interest. We don't want to exploit. I was with the deputy president. We spent days and days in Burundi having this negotiation, bringing peace. But we didn't get anything. All the contracts and all went to the West, you see, like in the DRC. So we didn't go there for any. Say, okay, we assist you, and therefore you must give us oil contract there and give us this and that and that. Which we don't mind getting it, because after all, we're part of Africa and you want the African state. But I think that we need to give this moral leadership to bring peace, and we think it's essential. Wherever wars are taking place in the world, our fundamental of our foreign policy is that we want to resolve conflict through dialogue, through negotiation, and through peace. We could do it in South Africa, and in a very difficult situation, people thought there would be a bloodbath. And we meet with our people. I one time went to Sri Lanka. We were negotiating there, and I went with Rolf Meyer, who was the Minister of Defense, the two of us. And he was introducing me. He said, you know, when Ibrahim was kidnapped from Swaziland, I was the Deputy Minister of Police at that time. It gives a good message that you could work together. I mean, and if you want to build, we say to the Iraqis too, he said to them, look, if you want to build your country, you've got to get rid of this sectarian violence. You've got to unite and forget what happened. Not to forget what happened in the past, but don't have retribution. And that's how, that is what we said, that no, our task was to build our country and not to start having retribution, etc. I don't know whether that answers the question.
I think you're quite right to point out that one has to be careful of being naive about an African agenda. Africa is a very big place. It's a very diverse place. But Africa is also investing in the African Union, so you have to ask, why are you doing that? Is there an African Union agenda, at least? And what is that agenda? You know? And I think we find ourselves as South Africa as a paradox, Minister. I don't know if you'll agree. I recall very well about 10 years ago being in a meeting with President Mbeki during the days when we were trying to get NEPAD off the ground. And we spent that entire day, I was heading the advisory body to the minister at that point, And we had all been assembled in this venue in Pretoria. And we were all being galvanized to really start giving effect to President's dream of the African Renaissance. And yet we were also trying to be incredibly cautious about the paradox about South Africa in Africa. And I remember President Mbeki came towards the evening and we said, we think we should exercise leadership, but we should do it from behind. President Mbeki said, well, when you go home this evening, or rather when you go to your offices this evening, not home, because none of you are going home, of course, take a look around your office and see what you've got in your office, email, faxes, telephones, etc., etc., which you take for granted. It doesn't exist in many parts of Africa. So I'm not sure what you're talking about leadership from behind. You've got to exercise leadership. But how you do it is very important because we're a relatively young democracy. We have to be very careful, and we also think we're an exceptional country, that somehow we think there's the South African exceptionalism. We shall never make the mistakes that every other African country has made. We shall never go the path that every other African. And I think we must be very modest and humble that we haven't had 50, 60 years of independence like many other countries have. We are only 18 years young. And therefore, on the one hand, indeed, we're relatively highly developed compared to the rest of Africa. We probably produce 70% of the scientific articles in Africa. Our universities are probably the most powerful institutions in Africa in terms of science and technology. That's why we've won the SKA $25 billion to build the biggest telescope in the world in the next 10 to 15 years. So we have incredible prowess in science and research and so on. But at the same time, we're a relatively young country. And so how we navigate ourselves on the continent becomes very important. And you may not hear this, Minister, but I certainly hear it from my fellow Vice Chancellors at other African universities and academics who are fearful of South Africa. They are fearful of a South Africa that becomes a new colonizer. And so the fact that we don't get the big contracts for oil and so on, perhaps that says something. But there are parts of Africa, I know, that are incredibly fearful of the role that South Africa could come to play in their countries. I don't know if you experience any of that, and how do you mediate that paradox, if you like?
Well, yes, of course. There are some rivalries you'll obviously have. You know, we want a reform of the United Nations. Whether that will take place or not, I don't know. We said Africa should have a permanent seat in the Security Council. Now, you could already feel some, I won't say tension, but some some countries are placing themselves in a certain position to place certain big powers that, you know, if there is, that's one aspect of it. Of course, South African business has invested. You know, you go there, you get MTN, the cell phone, you get the Standard Bank.
Nando's, Woolworths, they're all over Ghana.
I don't see Nando's here.
Not yet.
East Coast, yeah. That's the best you can get, yeah.
McDonald's.
Yes, there is a feeling sometime. You know, we had a... A few weeks ago, there was a vice president of Nigeria came to South Africa, and we have a bilateral with the vice president and our deputy president as part of the meeting. You could see that our relations were somehow frosty, and we tried to get and we think certain, you know. Powers are trying to, you know, the Nigerians, a lot of our companies are in Nigeria, I think 160 or some odd. And the Nigerians feel that when they come, they don't have the same opportunity to establish themselves in our country. Not that we don't create the enabling environment. For some reason or the other, they've not succeeded. Not because there's something that's hampering them, you see. And they feel, well, we're becoming a big power and we want to colonize them. But the others, of course, are very keen. For instance, as Egypt and Tunisia and Libya. And I didn't go to Libya, but the Libyans came to South Africa with the diaspora. And they all are saying that in the past, we were more to the north. Egypt was more concerned with the Arab states, Tunisia with the Mediterranean state. But now we want to be Africans. We want to be part of the AU. We want relationship with you. We want to be part of Africa, because we are Africans, you see. And it's an encouraging thing to draw them into. You say, no, you're part of Africa. Let us develop Africa together. Let us find peace in our continent, and let us begin to see how we can share the wealth of our continent. So, yes, I wouldn't dispute that we have. There are some probably resentment that South Africa is a well-developed country. It has all the infrastructure. It's got all the financial institutions. It has got a very, very free press. I don't think anywhere in Africa you have a free press as we have in South Africa. Very anti-government press, too, but that's by the way, you see. And we got a very, very independent judiciary, which I don't think any of the African countries could compete with our press and our judiciary. We are a constitutional state, and we have these tensions, and one of the big tensions is that when we at the human rights, we voted for gay rights, and the African and the Arabs just walked out, and so forth. So there are tensions that do exist. But I think on the whole that Africans do realize that we are an important country in Africa. We are an important role player because we are part of the G20. We are a member of the Security Council. But our task is to put forward wherever we are, whether we are in IPSA, BRICS, G20, or the Security Council, we need to put on the table the African agenda. We need to work for the good of Africa. And I think many Africans do realize that, despite the little problems that they have, and also the type of foreign interventions that may come about now and again.
I saw a hand somewhere else. Indeed, a very independent judiciary and media. But
I've
with
got
a few
the
dark
microphone,
clouds.
So... What power? Well, in the U.S., it's often a matter of conflict and dispute about how much foreign aid we give and how involved we are in other countries. And I wondered if that was also true in South Africa in relation to the African Union, for instance. Do you have isolationists who say we shouldn't have anything to do with all this? We have enough to do at home. And then, because you've already spoken about this, I'll slip in a quick question about the tragedy of AIDS on the African continent. Do you feel that the worst is over, that the corner has been turned on that? That's all.
Well, the question of AIDS, I'm glad you raised it, because we have this AGOA treatment where African goods come into the United States duty-free. We have benefited a lot, and we need to thank the Americans for that. Our motor industry, for instance, come to 20% of, I think, BMWs. BMWs or Merck, was it the BMWs, isn't it?
BMWs and Mercedes.
Mercedes come to States. 2015, the AGOA treatment has come for review. And there's a feeling in the United States or in your Congress, which we want you to lobby for us, in your Congress people, and that South Africa or Africa or South Africa should be reduced, should be removed from the AGOA treaty. And even Africa for that matter. We get a lot of aid from the United States on HIV/AIDS. We get $500 million a year. Even that, too, the Americans are saying that they want to stop that, that, which will have a rather bad, it, well, you know, with the antiretroviral, $500 million, it goes to the NGOs who are fighting AIDS. And yes, I must say that the United States has given a lot of AIDS to Africa. And somebody was complaining this afternoon at one meeting that the aid that the United States gives is not made public, even to the American public. I'm not sure why. But we hope that at least AGOA and this medical aid is called PAPFAR would continue to assist not only Africa but the continent.
Okay, well, unfortunately, we've reached almost the end of our program tonight. I would like to let our audience listening at home tonight know this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight, South Africa's Role in Conflict Resolution. We've had Dr. Salim Badat, Vice Chancellor of Rhodes University, in conversation with Mr. Ibrahim Ishmael Ibrahim, who is Deputy Minister of International Relations and Cooperation of the Republic of South Africa. It's been a wonderful program. I'd like to end this evening by asking each of you, starting with Dr. Badat, just to give us a very brief wrap-up of your feeling about conflict resolution and South Africa's role in the world today, especially for us Americans.
Sure. Well, I certainly agree with Deputy Minister that South Africa has a special role to play, and it comes with the moral authority of an exceptional person, Nelson Mandela, and I think though at the same time I empathize with the Deputy Minister and our international relations section. You also have to find how you're going to navigate that slippery pathway between the pragmatics and principles, and I think sometimes those principles have been challenged in the UN and elsewhere. And I would certainly hope that that kind of authority that we had beginning with our democracy in 1994, based on some very important moral, ethical values, that that kind of role continues to be played around the globe and in Africa more generally, notwithstanding the necessity, I suppose, of realpolitik and pragmatism from time to time.
Thank you. Mr. Ibrahim?
Yes, I agree with Mr. Badat. I think that we have, as far as foreign policy is concerned, number one, we have a very independent foreign policy. We take a decision independently, even if some of the countries in our continent or internationally do not agree with us. Secondly, we want to focus strongly, and we have been focusing strongly on human rights issues. And I think that's an important component of our foreign policy. And of course, thirdly, as I said earlier, that we want conflicts to be resolved by dialogue, negotiation, and peaceful. And we do not think at the end of the day military solution is the best solution to resolving conflict. We think that conflict should be resolved. And I think that there should be a transformation of the international multilateral bodies. We firmly believe in multilateralism. And we are opposed to any unilateral action anyway. Thank you.
Okay, thank you both. Our program tonight has been South Africa's Role in Conflict Resolution with Dr. Salim Badat and Mr. Ibrahim Ishmael Ibrahim. I'm Kevin O'Malley, Chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum. I'd like to thank our audience here at the club tonight and our audience listening at home for making this another great program here at the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of public discussion. And with this, our program is adjourned.